Okay, so thank you for organizing this nice program. I've learned a lot. Sometimes I think I should apologize here for being a statistical physicist. So I'm going to tell you a couple of intersections that I've had in neuroscience. And I will apologize for being somewhat not an expert in this field, but every now and then, a colleague of mine would come and show me some nice pictures from neuroscience, and I get inspired to think about it, and possibly not too deeply, but hopefully maybe from perspective that is different. And actually, currently, what I'm interested more is a model for something similar to postsynaptic density that forms naturally, and whether one can explain a little bit about synapses from some experiments that were done at École Normale by Antoine Triller. If I have a chance, maybe I'll say a few words about it, but I think a problem that may be more interest to this current audience is something that I worked on before, which has to do with the orientational selectivity patterns. And this was inspired by another colleague, Merigan Kasur at MIT, that came to me at some point with a picture such as this, which is orientational selectivity in a cat. And I'll explain a little bit about that and my perspective on this. So what Merigan showed me in his lab was you had a cat that was anesthetized, and its eyes were kept open, looking at a TV screen, and on the TV screen, you were showing lines of different orientation, and using a method of optical imaging, the visual cortex of the cat that was open, they were looking at it, and it was responding differently when lines of different orientation were presented on the screen. And so basically, when the lines were horizontal, the regions in the cortex that are in red would respond. When the lines were at this angle, the yellow, etc. And so you get this nice rainbow of colors and pictures such as this. So he sort of told me several things about these patterns, and I read a few papers, and not really being an expert in the field, there were a few concepts that I tried to look at that made potentially some sense to me and I could contribute. So one of the words that sort of stuck out in my readings and descriptions is that these patterns are diverse. What does that mean? It means that practically all orientations are reflected in these patterns. Of course, it makes sense. You don't want to just respond to horizontal lines. That would be a poor visual system. So all patterns are all lines are represented more or less uniformly. There is continuity. That is, if you look at some location, as you go and look at neurons that are close by, the orientation doesn't suddenly shift from one direction to another direction. There's this continuous rainbow as you go most directions. But there are exceptions. There are points in this map where all of the orientations seem to be pointing towards the center. And so that's in that literature called pinwheels. I guess in physics we would call them vortices. And so these were the things that were pointed out. Of course, you get essentially the similar thing if you take a film of liquid crystal and look it under polarizer light. You will get patterns that are very similar to this. And is there some useful thing that one can take from one field to shed light on the other? Well, being a physicist, what I like is symmetry. And so the question is, can one say anything about the symmetries of this pattern? Symmetries are good. You either have them or not have them. And an interpretation of the diversity term that I had seen in the literature was that the patterns that you have possess rotational symmetry. That is, you can't tell some particular orientation if you were to sort of rotate everything, you would say see the same thing. Now, rotational symmetry sounds simple. There is a slight subtlety to it, however, if you think about it. So suppose I look at this arrow. It's a bunch of lines on a map. Can I take that and rotate all of the lines by 45 degrees? Just doesn't make sense. You have to rotate the map along with the angles, and that makes sense. Now, these are two different implementations of rotation symmetry. And in physics, this would be the symmetry that you would have for, say, a superconductor. This would be the symmetry that you would have for a liquid crystal. And so it makes sense that you should have potentially this type of symmetry as opposed to that symmetry. Another way of thinking about it is, again, say, what are liquid crystals? They are liquids in which you have long molecules. And if you think of these two molecules and their centers, you can see that you have more fluctuations here, less fluctuations here. So it matters whether things are parallel like this or parallel like this. They are two different concepts. Now, why should that make any difference? Why should you even care about it? Well, think about a situation where you have two lines where you can rotate them independently of each other. So you have a lot of flexibility as long as the only thing that you require is that these two should be parallel. But suppose the situation where they are parallel to the line that joins their center is the one that is more favorable as opposed to this. And indeed, in the picture that I show you over here, you will see that most of the time, lines want to be parallel to the direction of the orientation that separates them. You can see that in this situation, you have much less flexibility than the other case. And indeed, you can prove mathematically that if you have one type of symmetry, the restricted symmetry that cares about space as opposed to the other, the pattern that you will have considerably more of these pinwheel singularities than the other. So this just makes sense. I mean, you have, if you have to have an additional constraint to worry about, you are less flexible, you're going to have more pinwheels. Okay? So that's one observation. But you can say, well, this is a map. It exists. People have this picture where at each point you have an orientation. Can you look at that picture and rotate everybody like I have done over here and see whether it is statistically a similar picture or not? And so what for that, what you can do is you can indeed look at two points on the map that are, let's say, at a fixed separation and ask how likely it is if this is in this direction that this other one should be at some angle and whether it makes difference whether it is located here or here. Here it would be orthogonal along the line that is orthogonal to it, it would be parallel to it. So we did that. You can take the data from the cat or a monkey, and what you find is that there is indication that the statistics and the symmetries of these maps are more along the lines that would correspond to this symmetry as opposed to that symmetry. Not surprisingly, it was actually somewhat less than I would have expected. I would have expected to see a much more significant difference. But that's the way it is. You really don't see, you do see definite signature that the symmetry that you have to consider is this, but you don't see that big of a difference. Okay, so then I asked myself, well, maybe I'm basing things on images such as this because I'm thinking about a restricted set of things. After all, presumably what is happening, the way that these image maps are formed through evolution or whatever, have something to do with the way that the visual system wants to interpret the natural worlds and the images that it sees, etc. And so we can ask the same question about the natural world. I mean, currently our picture is that most of the things that we see in natural worlds are lines that are continuing. So maybe there are interactions that are prefer lines to be like this. But even if you look at this, there's this line goes here, but there's this line goes to here. Which one of them is more common, right? So you don't know. What you can do is you can take a bunch of natural images and try to ask that question of the symmetry, its absence, its strength, etc., from those images. But now we have to ask several questions. So the ideal thing is you take a camera, you go and take a bunch of pictures, and you start analyzing them somehow or the other. But you immediately see the questions that you have to ask, because clearly if I click my camera here and go around looking at different places, I'm sort of initially sampling different things, but statistically I should be averaging over all of those things. So there is a translational issue that I have to take care of. Also, most of the times, there is a tendency that we have horizontal, vertical, but you also look at things at different angles. So there's the rotation of the images that I have to take care of. Also, as I walk to you, the scale that I'm seeing things is going to change. So how can I distinguish the difference between images wanting to go straight lines or tending to be vertical, keeping track that I don't want to be confused by translations, rotation, scale invariance, etc. Now, group of people, Bialik, Ruderman, etc., faced a similar question and answered it. What they were interested was not lines in natural images, but that as you take a picture, there is variations in intensity. So you take black and white pictures, and black and white pictures, you pixelate them. At each pixel, you have some number that is the intensity at that point. And you can ask, how are these intensities varying from one position to another position? So what they eventually did among various analyses that I'm going to rely on is they did a Fourier scaling. So they took the images and they did a power spectrum. I should probably go immediately down here. This is actually a bad reproduction of an image from a woods that even in the paper you can't see. So this has nothing to do with the projector. Okay. So what they did was in this plot is the power spectrum. So you take these images of the intensity, you Fourier transform them, you calculate expectation value of the intensity at a particular value of the wave vector Q or wavelength lambda. And what they found is that the intensity has this kind of a power law dependence. One of these power laws you can argue with. For me, I would have actually been surprised if it wasn't the power law, because as I said, I expect things to be irrespective of your perspective. So it can be that if I look at this perspective, I see the chairs at some particular size, but if I go towards them, the size of the chairs changes. So there shouldn't be a characteristic wavelength. If this was not a power law, I would have been worried about it, but I won't interpret the exponent that they see. So the question is, I want to do a similar thing to what they did, but I don't want to look at the intensity of images. I want to gain some information about the orientations. How should I do that? One step of the process is actually easy. There are filters that exist that can take a picture and then convert that picture by some gradient type of filtering, etc., to locally whether or not you have a line or something like this. So you take your picture that is originally intensity, you run it through these filters, and it will give you a bunch of these lines. But how can I now distinguish this difference that I had between things going this way and going this way? Well, Fourier transforms give you a means for doing that. Because when you're Fourier transforming, you first pick a particular direction, a k vector. So the question that I can ask is, along that k vector, are lines more like this or more like this? So what do I have to do? I take a particular k vector and look at the Fourier components that are parallel to that or orthogonal to that. And in physics, we would call these respectively the longitudinal component and the transverse component. Okay? And so what we did was very similar to what Jalek and Ruderman did, except that we did this additional step of converting things to orientations in the intensity from the intensity maps, and then decomposing the Fourier transforms into the transverse and the longitudinal component. And what you find is that roughly given the size of the images, et cetera, that you will get a distinction between the transverse and the longitudinal components. So images tend to have more variations orthogonal to the direction that you have, at least the subset of natural images that we looked at. And something like this had actually been looked at from a slightly different perspective by another group. Let me actually just show you this picture. So this is a picture of a cow. This picture, the colors actually correspond to the orientations that the filter would pick. And so you can see that all the verticals are yellow in this picture, for example. And then you can go and analyze it. And this was the picture that I showed you. But what I wanted to tell you is another group that had analyzed natural images from a different perspective. They had looked at the statistics that if you have a line like this and go at some angle, how likely it is that you will find a line like that in the images that they are looking at. And their conclusion was that you get a preponderance of circles, which means that very roughly you can get the statistics of these images that we got, more or less, by considering a world that is composed of circles that are randomly distributed all over the place and radii that have all possible values to maintain the scaling variance. And so this is one interpretation that you can have of this transversality of natural images. But you can ask, well, can you give me something slightly different? Like, can I visualize what it would be if it was more or less transverse than natural images? And indeed, it turns out that modern art provides you the means for doing that. And so if you go and analyze these same things for modern art, you will find that things like impressionist pictures, like this one, there is no distinction between longitudinal and transverse. Last week, actually, there was a exhibition of Van Gogh at the Museum of Fine Art in Santa Barbara. You could have seen some of these pictures. Similarly, Pissarro. But that if you go and look at cubists, you will find that the ratio between transverse and longitudinal is more than you would have expected on natural images. So you can sort of imagine what's going on from that perspective. Okay. Now, why? And let's go back to this continuity. Why is it useful that as you go from one point to a neighborhood? Yes. People, okay, there was a discussion that there's a group, very small group of people who do some things. There's a group of two people who do this thing. So I can tell you, no, we haven't done this. As far as I know, nobody else has done transverse longitudinal separation. Yes? Yes. Yes. Right.
So how is what you're doing, how is it similar to the Gabor? I mean, can that work?
Again, I'm not really an expert in this field, but the Gabor filter sounds familiar to me because that's actually one of the filters that we use to convert from intensity measures to line images. But as far as I, or at least the implementation of it that we were using, was purely local.
So they are essentially doing, they are measuring the direction.
Yes.
At multiple scales.
Uh-huh.
And that is what they are,
okay,
measuring of an image.
Okay. I see. Okay. Yeah. So what we were doing was we were only using it at a single scale. What we are saying is that if we use it at different scales, it may provide the same information about how things content changes with scale. Yes, that's true. I guess what I should say here is that there are similar things that people have done. But I personally find the language of transverse longitudinal somewhat more familiar as a physicist, and I think it provides a more useful explanation of decomposition. Okay? So there was this issue of continuity, that is, neighboring cells tend to prefer similar orientations. So if I were to guess as to why that is, one potential guess would be that it is a means of correcting errors. That is, most of the images that we see here, things don't change very much from one location to another location. And so then this information is transmitted to our neurons. Now suppose that somehow the information coming from this point, this pixel, got corrupted. If I were to poll my neighborhood, and I knew that most of the time in my neighborhood I'm at the same location, I would have a means of correcting that error. So the question is, suppose you want to generalize this, but rather than thinking about intensity and pixels at each point, thinking about the orientation that you have at each point, what kind of averaging would you have to do? And the thing is that what you can then do is to make a distinction. If you go in space along this direction, whether you want to pick the component of the orientation that you see that is parallel to the direction that you are traveling or perpendicular to the direction that you are traveling. So within your polling or filtering or averaging, you can also implement issues that correspond to this symmetry, and it turns out that this is a case for Trishru. What they looked at was the neurons in V1, and it turns out that most of the pictures that people have about V1 is that there is feed-forward information coming from the retina and the lateral geniculate nuclei, but there also happen to be horizontal corrections within V1. That's statement number one. Statement number two, it was also known that most of the horizontal connections connect neurons that prefer the same orientation. What was discovered in this paper and reported was that suppose you pick a cell whose preferred orientation, say, is in this direction, and then ask in which direction do the connections go. And it turns out that you are more likely to connect to cells of the same orientation preference that are along the direction that you're pointing as opposed to perpendicular. So these two cells are the same orientation, these two cells are the same orientation, you're more likely to go this way as opposed to that way. And that will provide you a useful way of filtering information and polling when your images are based on orientations as opposed to intensities. So basically, we tested this by posing a kind of filter which essentially works on a field where the variables are not scalars but are vectors, so they have this index S. Somehow my thing vanished. Okay, so we have this index, the input, and there's the filter, and then we have the two components of the output or the decision about the orientation that you want to make. And so what we tested that was a field of orientations. Some places you have orientation, some places you don't. Clearly here you see a line. There's a lot of background noise in orientation, and there's a gap. And we ask how the different filters would do in figuring out what is in this square, which is where the gap is. And what we find is that if I don't pay any attention to the distinction between orientations that are like this as opposed to this, I will reproduce this because of the noise. But if I mainly look at orientations that are connected like this, I will get a pattern like this. So that's the end of the story. I think in this particular example, by looking at symmetries, we were able to make connections between natural images, what the brain has to do, and the connections that it forms, again in terms of symmetry, and that somehow maybe all of this is related to this feature that is the pinwheels that you observe, and that maybe if you take your cat and put it in the impressionist wing of the museum, you have to start from childhood that it will have fewer pinwheels than the normal cat. Okay, so I think that's the end of this story. If you have, maybe that's a good point to end. If you like, I can tell you a little bit about the other story. But...
okay.
Yes, yes. And so when we looked at this, I guess we started being ignorant, so we didn't know that. But then we saw that a lot of people were using XY models, and they were neglecting this symmetry. So that was one of the things that we observed, that there were a bunch of models that were sort of obtained by taking an initial random set of orientations and then evolving in time. And they were using a model that was like a superconductor. And then those models, they were not honest with it. They would run it for a while. After a while, they would freeze the picture and it would have a certain set of vortices in it. What they wouldn't tell you is that if they were to run it further and further, those vortices would annihilate and disappear. And our model, once we break that symmetry, does not have that difficulty.